Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Thursday. Keeley's giving me this look like I'm fired up. I'm fired up for some talking about USC Trojan football. It's our first Dan Weber, Keeley, your show of the new year. If you heard, we did a Harvey Hyde show yesterday, I believe it was. But yeah, we're coming back from the break. Got a lot of stuff we want to talk about here. If you have any questions or comments, podcast at uscfootball.com is the email address, or you could call or text us at 424-254-9141 is the number. Just to let people know, since our first show of the year with this crew, yeah, get on iTunes, give us some positive feedback, leave us a five-star review. That's always awesome. We should be available on any of those podcasting platforms out there. If you find one, you don't see the Peristyle Podcast on it, let us know. We'll make sure we're added there. But we're all over the place, and we do appreciate you listening to the show year after year after year. It's grown and grown, and it's awesome to hear from all of our listeners out there. So thank you so much for being part of our little show. And like I mentioned today, we got Dan Weber on the line, and we got Keeley Yore in studio, ready to talk some Pac-12 football. How you guys doing?
I'm consulting my PR firm before I can tell you how I'm doing. I kind of like to follow that Pac-12 model. So my PR firm will be getting back to you here in due time.
Well, how about you, Keeley?
I can't really follow that up. I'm doing well. Happy New Year to y'all.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year to everybody. And we got a lot of topics today. We want to talk a little bit about Cliff Kingsbury stuff, Bubba Bolden stuff. We're going to start off, I think, with some Pac-12 stuff. And then we got a bunch of questions to get to. So if you haven't listened to my podcast of champions, you should definitely go check that out, pac12podcast.com. We put it up on uscfootball.com. But David Woods and I, you know, David covers UCLA. We talk a lot of Pac-12. And that was like one of the big topics today. So John Canzano has been doing some really good work for up there in the Oregonian. And, of course, John Wilner at San Jose Mercury News and that news group. But what Dan had kind of alluded to is the Pac-12 and Larry Scott hiring a PR crisis firm to try to change the narrative and the view, you know, basically the perspective of what's going on in the Pac-12. Not that they would want to make the Pac-12 better, they would rather just change what the perception is. So that's the direction they're going. And then also a little bit earlier about selling a 10% share in the conference, which they've been really just relying on 100% ownership, but trying to sell for $500 million, 10% share in the Pac-12. This is some really strange ideas at this point. But it's in the Pac-12, you know, this is looking at the Pac-12 right now that went 3-4 in bowl games. The three wins were by a combined 4 points for the Pac-12. Washington State, I mean, you could argue the Pac-12 should have, I mean, I don't think Utah shouldn't have lost. They were up 20-3. Washington definitely should have lost. But the other three wins that the Pac-12 had, you could argue they should have lost all of those games too. I mean, it was just not a good bowl season, not as bad as last year. But the Pac-12 basketball, as bad as it was last year, is much worse this year. So maybe that's why this PR crisis firm, they're trying to fix it somehow, Dan. Instead of fixing the product on the field and the court, they're trying to fix what we think about the products that we see with our own eyes is pretty terrible.
Yeah, I mean, apparently they hired this firm during the instant replay review situation where, you know, they had an outside guy. He's not a, you know, their number two guy, Woody. Gosh, I can't even think of his last name now at this point. Got involved in that call in the USC Washington State game. And obviously the replay people underneath him and the people in the room were upset, and they started, you know, putting out the word that this, you know, shouldn't have happened, and the Pac-12 was in trouble, and they knew it. So they went out and hired Fleishman Hilliard, in a really big time national PR and, you know, crisis management firm. But I think it was originally to basically cover Larry Scott and, you know, and the inner workings of the Pac-12. But now it's come up with a 34-page, plan of how to partner up with friendly media people like the LA Times and the Players Tribune, and trying to get good stories from those people, as opposed to 2 years ago. And this is the exact reason why the SEC is the SEC and the Pac-12 is the Pac-12. The SEC put just three teams into the basketball tournament, and that, you know, obviously the Pac-12 or the SEC doesn't care as much about basketball as they do football. But that got them mad. They were upset. And they said, "We're not performing, well here." They went out and hired a guy to be the daily, you know, manager of college basketball for the Pac-12 or for the SEC, who works with the coaches, works with the schools, works with the officials every day. And then they went out and hired Mike Trangisi, who had put the Big East on the map as commissioner and had great connections with the NCAA. And they really worked at it. And just, you know, last year the SEC had, you know, did a much, much better job, a very impressive job by the SEC. And they went at it the way you should go at it. They worked harder at it. They competed better at it. They, you know, told schools when they hit an opening, here's, you know, we want this kind of a coach. We want, you know, and they, you know, they said, we got more money. We're giving you more money. We want some results. And they've done a great job in the SEC. You can't knock them for, you know, what they've done in basketball. Then you see what the Pac-12 is doing, and you think that's not the way, to get better. That's not the way to compete harder. You got to compete, and you can't just, you know, blow smoke out there and say, hey, what about this story or what about that story, or, you know, try to partner up with media outfits that are positive. I mean, they're lucky John Canzano did what he's done. I mean, I think the guy ought to get a Pulitzer for what he's done in terms of investigating the Pac-12 and how he's going to, you know, change their behavior. Unfortunately, I'm not sure they'll learn the right lesson from all the investigations that he's done. But it's not a good sign when they're out there hiring crisis PR firms.
Yeah, no, certainly not. John does a great job up there. And we've had him on our podcast of champions. It was great to listen to him and what he had to say going on. But it is a conference in crisis. I thought, to me, the Rose Bowl was really important because that's the one, you know, that was the big matchup. The Pac-12 was favored in 5 of the 7 bowl games and only won 3 of them. And, like I said, 3 of those 3 wins were by a combined 4 points, which is absolutely insane. But you look at I actually went to the Rose Bowl. I've never done the parade, so I did that. And shout out to Trader Joe's and Art. Well, Art, one of our listeners, Art. Thanks, Art. We end up trading tickets, Rose Bowl tickets. He gave me Rose Bowl tickets. He's a poster on the Peristyle. And him. So my mom was in town. He gave me tickets, and we sat with him and his buddy Jeff, and it was a great time. And I got him a couple of tickets to the parade, which Trader Joe's gave us a bunch of tickets to the parade. So thanks to them for that. And I've never done that before. Have you done that, Keely, growing up here?
I have not.
Yeah, it was definitely, you get up early. Like, you know, we're up at like 4:30 in the morning, but you had awesome seats. We were right in front of where the float broke down later in the parade. But it was a really cool experience. My mom loved it. I had some friends in from out of town, like out of the country from Germany. They loved it. And, but we had a good time, and the bowl game was fun. Just, it looked to me like Ohio State playing USC last year without the late comeback. Like Washington had that late comeback in the game. Just Ohio State sort of like puts a stranglehold on you, and they had better players, and they weren't going to try to take any risks and push the envelope. Washington had more yards and everything, but Ohio State was in complete control of that game. And I don't know, but I thought, to me, Dan, the Pac-12 needed to win that one or at least have a good showing. And yeah, it was a 5-point game, but it wasn't a good showing. Ohio State dominated that game.
Yeah, you would. It didn't look like there was anybody on Washington's team that would have started for Ohio State. Maybe Gaskin, I don't know, but they looked like they were playing at two different levels. And then Ohio State did what they did against USC and just said, "Hey, we don't have to do any more. They can't possibly catch us." And you got to give Washington credit. You know, they hung in there, but the difference between the two programs was pretty obvious, just the way it was last year with USC and Ohio State. Although I got a note from the Pac-12 PR firm that flow didn't break down. It was just going really, really slow so that people could get a good look at it. That's what they tell me. No breakdowns from the Pac-12 point of view. I will say that the TV people, you can tell they do not want to say much bad about the Rose Parade because they really tried hard to look the other way. When that float broke down, they just didn't want to go there. So maybe that's a kind of the way the Pac-12 is going to have people covering the games.
It was neat. I mean, it was definitely cool. The guys in the white jackets, they're walking around and help you. Yeah. There's like businessmen and from Pasadena that all, Coach Harvey Hyde's involved in all that stuff. We met one guy, his name was Tom Brady actually. And my friend Melanie, who lived with me for, years ago, she's from Germany and she brought her family, her husband and three kids. And the guy's like asking where we're from. And she said, Germany. And he's like, "Oh, my wife's from," and I can't remember the name of the town, some small town in Germany. And so it turns out that Melanie was born in this town that this guy, Tom's wife was from. And he was like the nicest guy. He's like, "Hold on here." And it's like 6:30 in the morning at this point or something. And he runs off and brings back some coffees and a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts for us and just gives it to us out there. And so cool. I mean, it was really like, it's first class. It's, this is the 130th year of them doing it. And you could see how important it is to the cities. I took a picture of like every float as they went by. So I don't know if I would do it a bunch of times, but it was definitely a fun experience. But and we were sitting in the Trader Joe's section. So when the Trader Joe's float came by, we were all cheering. It was a really cool float too. So that was,
yeah, I liked it. It was really, really neat.
It was neat. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I don't know how people do it if they do it every year, to get up that early and sit through it that long. But, I know when my nephews came in from Australia, we went to where they put the floats together and, when they roll them out, a couple of days beforehand and all that. And I enjoy, that was my way of doing it. Getting up that early and being that cold, probably not the way, I'm going to go, but seeing those floats, they're unbelievable.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. The little kids from Germany, had no idea what the parade was, but they all got into it. So it was fun. So I definitely recommend it. And thanks again to, Trader Joe's for doing that. We had a question about, there was one Pac-12 game that we haven't really got to talk about. The Cheez-It Bowl was, that was something. Now, you could say it was like the greatest bowl ever or the worst bowl ever. Probably the worst bowl ever was the 7-6 Oregon win over Michigan State. That was one of the worst ones you're ever going to see. But I got this question for you, Dan, and then we'll talk about it. Here you go.
Hi, guys. This question is for Dan. Seriously, how did USC lose to this Cal team? That must be one of the worst bowl games, maybe even the worst football games I've ever seen. I'm just going to leave it at that because there's really nothing more to say. Fight on, Jason, Longhorn Country.
Yeah, Jason, I mean, that's the one you look at and you just say, how are the people responsible for the loss to Cal still in charge? I mean, and I know Clay has apologized for the three close losses that, cost him having a good season pretty much is kind of the thinking. And when you look at that Cal team and think any USC team in history lost to that Cal team, it's one of those, markers that you can't get away from. I mean, you cannot in any way walk away from what was a 15-14 loss and one of the worst coach games that anybody's ever seen. I mean, that's the game that makes this year worse than 5-7 is losing that game to Cal. I mean, TCU, I don't think they even had a quarterback, right? I mean, they were playing without a quarterback, couldn't throw the ball, and they still win against, with a 9-interception game. I mean, that's just...
There were 9 interceptions in that game.
It's impossible to explain how USC lost to Cal at home. It's impossible. You can't explain it. You just can't. There's no way to explain it.
Yeah, it was. But I think it was going back, like looking at some of the crappy games, like Stanford beating Pitt by a point and Oregon beating Michigan State by a point. Like those were just not fun games to watch. Like that, the Cheez-It Bowl was like trending on Twitter. Like everybody was watching. It was like another interception and another interception. It was like, it was pretty freaking awesome. Like I think looking back, it's a good train wreck kind of game where there's just some terrible games. Like that was pretty good.
Oh no, that was a great game for college football in a lot of ways. I mean, it was the number one. It was number one on Twitter. I mean, it was the number one trending, item on Twitter. I mean, we're talking about all the things that are happening in the world. That game was, got the number one. So it was. You couldn't take your eyes. It was one of those, train wrecks that you can't take. Can't take your eyes off of it because you knew the next time somebody tries to throw the ball, down the field, that their team wasn't going to catch it. And it was wonderful stuff, actually.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, okay, so that's the kind of Pac-12-ish stuff. There's some USC-ish stuff that we need to discuss. Maybe we'll start with...
I was just thinking, if you're the Pac-12 right now, putting together a bowl highlights reel, how do you do that? Wouldn't that be one of the greatest creative challenges ever to put together a Pac-12 bowl highlight reel for this year? Man.
You could show Stanford's...
Fleischman Hiller handle that.
Yeah. Stanford's, their only third down conversion. You could play that play because they only converted one third down. I think Oregon converted on 2 third downs, so they did double the production that Stanford had.
They made their extra point.
They did make the extra point. They had one of the worst. Yeah, they had part of the worst fake field goals you'll ever see that just blew up and was awful. Those games were pretty bad. But the Cheez-It Bowl, now that was some quality. When you're in overtime and it's 7-10, like that show, there was some offense in that game, man. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Overtime, 7-10.
There were a lot of Pac-12 bowl teams very thankful for early signing period this year.
Yeah.
Get them signed before we have to play that bowl game, man.
Crazy. Well, let's talk about, there's some, reports out there. USC, if you don't know, hired Cliff Kingsbury, who was, did you know that, Keely? He was fired by Texas Tech, his alma mater, after 5 seasons. I think his winning percentage was somewhere in the 35% range. Like, not great. He was 5-7 this past year. I don't think Texas Tech was looking to fire him. They didn't want to. They'd love for him to be successful, but they just needed to win more games. So they move on, and USC is the beneficiary, and they get Cliff Kingsbury. And there was that delay when he was first hired because there was NFL interest. Well, now the reports are there's still NFL interest to be not just an NFL offensive coordinator, but a head coach. So fired from Texas Tech, and maybe a general manager or owner in the NFL would like to bring him in, the New York Jets or the Arizona Cardinals, but apparently would both be interested. There's 8 NFL head coaching jobs open right now, which is a lot. But I don't know, Dan, what do you think? I mean, you wouldn't begrudge a guy if he gets a chance to be an NFL head coach. You're like, yeah, go ahead. Like, go do it. I don't know if it'll happen, but we'll see.
I mean, I think his agent's doing a great job keeping his name alive out there. I think if you're the NFL right now, and it is a copycat league, and you've got a young quarterback, who do you want holding their hand? One of these guys that's been an assistant for 20 years and this is how we do it in the NFL. Or you read some of these guys that haven't covered anything but the NFL, and you can't go with a guy like, what's he know about the NFL? Or, you know, you look at, you know, McVay and you say, huh, maybe having a young guy with some fresh ideas. The players, you know, I think Pete Carroll changed the dynamic in the NFL where you can come in even with the, you know, 10 or 12 year veterans and still do some college type things and some rah-rah type things and have some fun about it and, you know, compete in the way you might more compete in college and get away with it. And so I think right now, you know, with Sean McVay has made it absolutely fine for people to talk to, you know, guys like Cliff Kingsbury. And, you know, you better be able to throw the ball in the NFL, and you can go out and hire, a defensive coordinator. But if you look at, you know, Cliff Kingsbury, and I know people say, well, what was his record? And I think it was 35-40 overall and 5-7 this year. But, you know, he had a Texas Tech team that had three different quarterbacks, none of whose names anybody knows, and not a single skilled player that would start at USC. And they put up 34 points on Texas. Now, that's 13 more than Georgia did. That's, you know, 21 more than USC did. And he was doing it with guys who couldn't start for either one of those teams. So, I mean, the guy's pretty, you know, certifiable in terms of knowing what he's doing. And he doesn't have to ask anybody, not copying anybody. USC's had enough of the copycat coaches. He just didn't have access to enough players at Texas Tech. After Texas and Texas A&M and Baylor and TCU, you know, take the, you know, the top guys. There aren't a lot of guys left for Texas Tech. But I think, you know, the NFL teams, they basically, I think they want to talk to him. They want to pick his brain. I mean, Sean McVay wanted to pick his brain here at the Rams. I mean, I think everybody in the NFL would want to talk to, to Cliff. As far as his insights into, you know, throwing the football, I think it's interesting. I heard Rod Gilmore the other night on a bowl game had one of the most interesting insights that I've ever heard. Because people talk about the NFL is where it's at, and that's where all this stuff happens and what have you. And as he pointed out, the way offenses are going right now basically started in high school. The high schools were where they really started implementing the air raid type attacks and the no huddles and all that. And it got to the point where colleges couldn't recruit enough quarterbacks who had not, you know, been in a shotgun their whole lives and hadn't, you know, thrown the ball. And therefore colleges have changed. And now we're finally getting to the point where the NFL is looking around and saying, you know, those are the quarterbacks that are available to us, the Patrick Mahomes and Sam Darnolds and Josh Rosen. And so the NFL is being forced to change. But it isn't because the NFL has necessarily been out front and figuring this stuff out. But, you know, they're reacting to the way football, you know, has been going. And that's why Cliff Kingsbury is in, you know, so much, demand at least to talk to people. I think the thing you got to think about is, that may not have been on his, you know, radar screen as far as coming out, and he wanted to come to USC because rightly so. I think he thought, I can make the most impact with the players they've got and where they are. I can make the most impact, in my career for the next year or two at USC. But, I just think it's football is changing to the point where that's not necessarily the case. I mean, these teams who want somebody to work with their young quarterbacks, they look around, they say, who better than a Cliff Kingsbury? You know, he doesn't have to deal with recruiting issues. He doesn't have to deal with defense. And you find, you know, the way the Rams have done it. And you get a really good special teams coordinator like they have, and you get a really good, you know, experienced defensive coordinator. And you let your personable, young, smart, you know, innovative coordinator, offensive guru, run the offense. And it worked with Bill Walsh and all the way back. You know, a lot of, you know, great coaches have been basically the offensive, you know, genius behind the team. I'm not saying that that's a slam dunk for Cliff to go that direction. But if you look around, guys like Pete Carroll and Nick Saban had some not such great times in the NFL. And it certainly didn't limit them when they came back to college. It wasn't a, you know, so it wouldn't be necessarily the kind of career damaging move for Cliff if he went that way. You know, again, if you're USC, and we are, you certainly don't want to see that happen. But, you know, it certainly wouldn't be the craziest thing that has happened this year if one of them just got blown away by him in his interview. And he's really good, you know, explaining what he does. And he comes across really, really well. And, you know, I don't think it's impossible that somebody could offer him. And that would be interesting. What happens then? If that happens, does he come back to USC and say, boy, I love college. I've got this offer, though. What are you going to do? And what would USC do at that point?
I don't know. I don't think there's much you can do, because that's like people like, well, you got to be loyal or whatever. Like, if you're offered an NFL head coaching job, I think you take it. Like, I don't think there's any – would you really
– what if he's got the offer, but he comes back to USC and says, I'd really rather be at USC. What does USC do at that point?
So then you're talking like you want Lynn Swann to essentially fire Clay Helton and make Cliff Kingsbury the head coach at that point?
Or do you say, for example, you'll be Clay, you know, will coach out this year with associate head coach in waiting, Cliff Kingsbury, and then Clay has a, you know, Mark Richt moment after the year and becomes, you know, associate AD for community relations for the rest of his life? I don't know. What would you do? I don't know. I would think you would have to think about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure USC would pull something like that off, but here's the issue is that we've covered the team. They're 5-7. There's a lot of USC fans that were upset canceling season tickets. They didn't like the renovation, the flying the banner. Like, there was a lot of negative stuff going on around the program. But the one big positive was this Cliff Kingsbury hire. If that's like, it's like you got, you know, if you're over Christmas, hopefully you get to watch the Christmas Story on TBS. They do it for 24 hours. And, you know, Ralphie wants his Red Ryder 200 shot carbon action, whatever, you know, he wants his BB gun. And it's like his dad says, oh, look behind the piano over there. And there's his gun. And he pulls it out. It's like the happiest day of his life. The greatest Christmas present he had received or would ever receive. That's kind of what Clay Helton and USC fans got with Cliff Kingsbury. But if you, it's like taken away before you even open it up and it's just gone. I don't think USC could make a hire anywhere near as Dan pointed out, like all the good things that Cliff Kingsbury could do in an offense. I don't know, even if you had an unlimited budget, what kind of hire you could make. Nothing close to what it would be for Kingsbury. I'm just worried about the fan base and, like, you know, just our Twitter mentions, everything, like the message boards. If something like that happens, I don't know what the fans are going to do. We've seen this a lot. It's just going to be crazy.
Yeah, I don't know where 2019. Do you just say, well, we know what's going to happen, but we're going to keep this coaching staff intact and go into 2019, even though we're opening the renovated Coliseum and we're hoping and, you know, the schedule starts out pretty tough and all that. I don't know. Do you do that or not? Do you just say, well, we'll kind of give up on 2019 and go back to the gumbo offense? I don't know. Because you got a new president coming on board and who might, you know, have some interest in what's going on in football or what's going on, you know, if there's nobody at the Coliseum. If you're the AD, do you want to stick around or do you want to take a chance that you didn't do anything when you had the chance and now are you stuck? I mean, I just think there's so many questions as to how that could play out. And all that. Where does the chairman of the board of trustees, Rick Caruso, is a, you know, a big hitter in so many ways. What does he want? You know, how does that all play out? I mean, I don't think they want to open a brand new, you know, renovated Coliseum and having nobody show up. That would be that'd be devastating, you know, not just for, you know, football, but the USC brand. As you know, you put $300 million into this and nobody's coming. I think there'd be some hard decisions that would have to be made at USC. I mean, I think there are people at USC talking about this in the war room who aren't absolutely convinced that, you know, Clay is absolutely locked in for next year, that so many things could play out that there's nothing absolutely certain for next year.
Wow. We shall see. Well, okay, so that's the Cliff Kingsbury stuff. There's also some Bubba Bolden stuff. Keely, you want to maybe give an update, and Dan, we'll get your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so earlier this week, I heard from a source in the Bubba Bolden camp that Bubba had received an email over the course of the holidays that he had essentially been reinstated at USC due to a change in state laws, I believe. They were going to reopen Bubba Bolden's case, and because of that, he was allowed to re-enroll at USC on January 7th for this upcoming spring semester. Now, the source said that Bubba has always loved USC. He's always dreamed about being a Trojan. But right now, as of now, he is verbally committed elsewhere and is currently still in his JUCO college. I've tried to hear more about that, but the source is kind of mum on that. So we don't really know where Bubba stands currently. But the thing about it is, like, a lot of people in the PE assume that Bubba was already back and whatnot. It's just he has the possibility to come back and enroll in classes. We don't know the full story about the program, the football program, what they think about that. And this doesn't mean that if they reopen the case, that doesn't mean that it's going to be in Bubba's favor necessarily. There could be an option where Bubba comes back and the university still rules against Bubba. So it is a risk for Bubba in that sense. But the Bubba camp is happy that they're at least getting progress on that front. But that's all I have for now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Bubba and USC is, as we found out while it was going on, which no one knew it was going on, apparently, including the USC coaches, until the day they were told that he had been suspended for 28 months, the day after they named him as a starter, if there's no communication between, the coaches and anybody on the outside and the, you know, tribunal that gave him the 28-month, suspension from USC, I mean, what if they come back in April and say, you know, we're reconsidering the Bubba case. You're only suspended for 24 months instead of 28 months or whatever, you know. I mean, who knows how you would trust you? I mean, USC's got the worst track record in these kinds of cases in the entire United States. I mean, they are the worst school in America. Been sued the most, lost the most. But you don't want exactly to be in a situation where the only recourse you've got is to sue them. One of the issues might be, though, that if Bubba finishes out the spring semester and it doesn't work out, he could still transfer and play somewhere next year, possibly. Whereas, you know, so he's not maybe taking a real risk with his future career if he comes back in the spring, and get a chance to practice in the spring. I just don't know how you, I mean, it's so secretive of what's going on at USC that I don't know, you know, and the lengths to which you're allowed to be represented by an attorney, or you're allowed to question the people that accuse you and all that kind of stuff is really, really, you can't pin it down, and it looks like this is another case of USC trying to head off a lawsuit. I mean, I'm not sure this is anything where they're saying, oh, we did a bad thing to Bubba, or Bubba deserves, you know, a fair hearing here. I think it's a more of a case of we keep losing these lawsuits, and now they said it was a state law, but I know the federal government has come down with a completely new and different ruling on how these cases are supposed to be handled. And therefore, there are all kinds of changes in the legal part of this that none of which look favorable to the way USC has been doing business. But you know, is it anything about, you know, I mean, how many people got those letters? We don't know. And USC, I think, is just trying to head off lawsuits because of the way they've been dealing, you know, with these things. And I wouldn't trust USC in terms of you know, of Bubba's case. I mean, wouldn't, because it doesn't look like there's anybody at USC who could guarantee him a fair hearing or a fair resolution. So if you don't have that, as much as you want to be part of USC and come back to USC, how do you do that? I just don't know.
Don't know either. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll keep you up to date on what we're hearing on the whole Bubba Bolden thing going forward. Well, let's jump into some questions, Keely. We had some questions, general questions about the team over the break, so we'll get into those with Dan.
Yeah, we have an interesting one to start off our question segment. Crystal in Monrovia actually says, watching the Rams versus the 49ers game this weekend, I noticed the huge shadow the scholarship tower casts on the field. I know the Coliseum crew had difficulties with the south sidelines. How are they going to grow grass in the shadows of the tower? I have difficulties growing grass under my one peach tree. Happy New Year. Love the podcast. Fight on.
All I know is the guy in charge of the grass at the Coliseum, he will figure out a way. I mean, the thing is, the problem is during, you know, the prime hours when they're, you know, playing, you know, the games, you do get those shadows. I mean, you know, you got a lot of hours of the day when there's sunlight. But I think the tower does more to damage the viewing, you know, possibilities, because the sun is, you know, so strong in one part of the field and you're in shade on the other. It really makes it tough on the TV cameras and all that. I think that makes it, it's not as bad when you're there in person, but it really makes those TV lenses that have to adjust to the bright part of the field and then the shadow part of the field. But yeah, that, the tower is going to give it a whole different perspective. And, you know, for the seats that are on alongside of the tower, all of that. But it'll be interesting. Yes, he's got a, as Keely and I know too well, a very dedicated grounds crew, and a you know, they work at it. So we'll see how that does. That's a good question, though. We should probably ask if it changes how they have to do the field with the tower. I hadn't thought about that.
You don't want them to say, oh, maybe it would, because then you're like, uh-oh, something that wasn't thought about. Because no one's ever done that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the other things, you know, that, you know, like the section, like there's a half a section on either side of the tower where you can't see the corner of the end zone at the other end. And I don't know what they're like on sellout games. Are they still going to have a half a section open on, you know, on both sides of the tower because you can't see the whole field from there? I don't know. It'll be weird to have, you know, your blimp flying overhead on a, although I guess just having a sellout crowd would be also a little weird probably at this point. But and then to have those half sections with nobody in them because of the scholarship tower. It's lots of questions. Like everything else with the USC football right now, way more questions than answers.
Dan has a fake rivalry with the ground crew at the Coliseum because every time we tried to set up for instant analysis, they're very dedicated to the point where they don't really care about people who are on the field. Like, you got to get out of their way.
Nice.
Well, yeah. And they seem to be always very interested in whatever plot of ground we happen to be standing on, mm-hmm. that's where the mowers have to go at that very moment. Yeah. Of course, they've got big earphones on and they just, but man, oh man, it is, it's like 100%. If you say, wherever we're going to be, they're going to be.
That's why we evacuated to high ground during the later instant analysis of the season.
Gotcha. Get off that grass.
Inside baseball. We have a question from Tom in the South Bay. He says, change of culture, how would that happen? Clay, instead of replacing John Baxter, gave him more responsibility at the tight end position, and he promoted an assistant to coach the linebackers. This assistant has not coached linebackers for 20 years because he's a special teams coach. How do you expect anything to change as long as Clay's doing what he does best, making bad decisions? By hiring Cliff, he thinks the issues are resolved, but to me, it is a great hire, but is he a one and done? He will not stay at USC. He may not even finish a year as he is in great demand. Your thoughts, please. Fight on, Tom.
Tom's always positive.
Yeah,
he's positively upset at what's going on.
Yeah, the thing with Clay is, with Cliff is, he might not make it to the first practice, and he might be here as a head coach, anywhere in between. It's just like impossible to decide. It looks to me like when they talked about USC, Lynn and Clay talked about the Notre Dame model, which turned out changing everybody, basically all the coordinators, changing people in the strength and conditioning and everything you could change, 17 personnel in total in the football, on the football staff. And I mentioned that to Clay, and he got this look on his face of like sheer horror. The thought that 17 people, maybe three, something like that. The USC is going a completely different way. And I don't know if that's because they did not want to go out and hire a bunch of new coaches. And you would have had to offer them all multiple year contracts. You weren't going to get people unless you bumped up an analyst or a grad assistant. You weren't getting people to come to USC for 1 year contracts at this point in time. So I'm not sure they had a lot of flexibility in terms of if Clay was going to stay. I don't know that there were much opportunity to do a lot else, because I just think that USC was not going to offer multiple year deals. Maybe one or two of the new coaches, got multiple year deals. I'm sure Cliff did, but that wasn't going to extend to the whole staff, like where they could have, gotten rid of basically the whole staff and brought in a whole new staff. That wasn't going to happen. So I think it's kind of a, sink or swim for Clay with this year, with the thought being that if it doesn't work out this year, you don't have to pay off a lot of multiple year deals for assistant coaches, that they'll pretty much have run their course. So I'm not sure, that the decision making, I don't know that Clay had as much freedom to really go out and, pick a whole new, staff of assistants. But yeah, it's hard to say you're changing the culture when you're keeping the defensive coordinator, you're keeping the special teams coordinator, you're keeping the head coach, who called the plays. You're keeping the same people basically running strength and conditioning and nutrition. And you haven't made an obvious effort to bump up the staff in the recruiting department. Doing all those things basically the same way makes it basically impossible to change the culture. Cliff Kingsbury will make a big change as much as he can possibly do. But to say you're going to change the culture when you keep everybody pretty much in place, not happening.
Yeah. Tom, Tom's a glass half empty kind of guy. But I get you. I there's some people that are saying, oh, well, he could leave after a year, or he might not stay right away. I think you need to make hires like this. I think it was a good hire. I don't think enough. I don't think it was enough, though. I think you needed to do more. So I do agree with that. And what kind of position is USC going to – because you only did that, if you do lose him right away, it would have been good if you brought Cliff Kingsbury in but also made some other big changes. That was the only one. So you're putting all your eggs in that basket. If he does go for an NFL job, now you're back to square one. You certainly haven't done enough to change all those things Lynn Swann talked about at that point. It's a big one. And I think you can win three more games just on Kingsbury, scoring more points. I really think you could. But, you might not keep him very long. You got to make sure you're putting his system in place and you're going to get someone to replace him, and you basically get rid of the gumbo and you bring in this, however form you could do it. As of now, you need him, though, at least a year, though, to kind of install everything. If he leaves right away, what are your options out there? And I don't know, but I agree with Tom. It's not enough, but it's definitely a good step. So anyone that was critical of that, I don't get that.
No, it's the best step you could have made in the country. Of all the choices you could have had, all the things you could have done, I think it's the number one thing that was available to USC in the entire country. The things that I think needed to be done, and maybe they will get around to them, but it doesn't matter who the coach is next year or the year after or the year after. You need a really competitive strength and conditioning program. You need a really competitive nutrition program, and you need a really competitive recruiting program. All of those changes could have been made without any, it doesn't matter who the head coach is. Doesn't matter who the assistants are. If you were in a season where you're saying we extended Clay, or we're going to keep him over a year, we're going to keep most of the assistants over, but we're going to change a bunch of stuff, they could have done that. Now, maybe they'll come back, and after 6 weeks we haven't heard anything, but maybe they'll come back and say, yeah, we were going to do this all the time, or yes, we are going to do this, or here's how we're changing, the personnel and the hours and the kind of things that we're going to have, for nutrition at the Galen Dining Center, or here's what we're doing in the weight. We're going to have, someone dedicated to football and football only, like, the really good programs have. Or here's what we're going to do in, this is what Clemson does. Clemson doesn't spend as much money in football as USC does, but they do an unbelievable job recruiting. And you go and you say, we're going to do, similar to what Clemson does. And you could do that because it doesn't matter who the coach is next year or the year after. But those needed to happen. Haven't seen any signs of that yet, but we need to see that.
Keeping along those same lines, we have a question from Nick from Cyprus, aka Big Nick 21 USC from the P. He says, question is, why would Clay Helton keep Clancy P? He's a one-trick pony, which the conference has figured out, especially with Clay and Lynn Swann saying we can use the ND model, Notre Dame model, to become great again, yet we kept him and John Baxter.
I just think there's a comfort level, familiarity level, a thought that you couldn't go out and hire. I mean, when the defensive coordinator at LSU is getting paid more than four or five of the head coaches in the Pac-12, if you wanted to go out on the market and replace the defensive coordinator with somebody, who is one of those kind of, high-profile guys, USC didn't have the money to do that. I mean, they weren't going to give – I mean, obviously USC has the money if they want to do stuff like that, but they weren't going to have the money to do it this year, for Clay, not knowing what's going to happen after 2019 or even, going into 2019. So I just think there wasn't any opportunity really to do that if I, read things, properly. I mean, and I guess there's always a chance that Clancy does decide that, that there's an NFL job out there for him and, they have to, go hire somebody. But I don't think they had, Clay had the freedom to just go out and, get rid of this staff and go out and come up with a new staff. That just wasn't going to happen.
Dustin Perlberg, I believe that's how you say his last name. He says, I know there's some criticism, and it's fair criticism, with keeping Kerry Colbert and Tim Drevno, considering they aren't well-versed in the air raid offense. I could be wrong, but didn't Sark use wider splits on the offensive line when he first got the head coaching job? If so, maybe that's one piece of the puzzle that Drevno has some experience with. Thanks in advance for the memory check, Dustin.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that their familiarity or not with the air raid is going to be that big of a problem. I think there are so many basic fundamental things about football, that carry over from one system to the next. I mean, obviously, you don't want the guy who's, the coordinator the guy that's installing the game plan to be trying to, you know, figure out what is it that that guy does who really knows how to run this offense. But I think with a guy like, I do think, with Cliff and getting the running backs coach, I think just having the way they use the running backs, I thought the fact that they used two, a decent amount of time, and the fact that they, you know, Texas Tech was able to run the ball when they had the right guys, you know, back there. I just think, I think having those two, I think gets the job done. I just don't see that there is like a special way to coach the offensive line in the air raid, and I don't think that there are necessarily different ways to run your individual stuff that you run, as a wide receivers coach. The idea of having two wide receivers coach, an inside receiver coach and an outside receiver coach, kind of like that, USC won't have that. That might not have been, a bad way to go. But otherwise, I think, I hope this gives, Kerry a chance to really, show what he can do as a coach. I mean, he's got the pedigree. Pete Carroll always said he was the number one guy of all the players he coached that he thought would be a coach. And, he had all the years at the years in the NFL, then the years at Alabama. So he's got a lot of background. Just hope that it can show through this year with this offense is the way. And I think Drevno is pretty, adjustable. I think he did a pretty decent job trying to do what he was doing last year. I think the fact that he did have the running back, coach responsibilities last year probably helps him moving forward and trying to, coordinate the offensive line and the running backs and all that. So I'm not real down on those guys staying, knowing all the issues that USC has. It's not going to be a perfect world next year. I just think you got to make, Kingsbury work for you. It's got to, and Ryan said 3 wins. I think he could make the case it's a 5-win difference. I mean, here's a guy, they scored almost 40 points a game against basically the same schedule USC played. I mean, a very comparable type of schedule in the Big 12 that USC played. And what would USC have been with, if they scored 40 points a game last year? And USC had better players than Texas Tech. So if they perform anywhere near what his players have done over the years, I think that it changes a lot. I mean, I think USC doesn't need, I think they'd have a chance to win 10 games last year. And they're going to be better next year. They got better athletes. I mean, they've got good athletes who are going to be a year older and coming back from a year that they all want to forget about. I think he makes a big difference. Kingsbury does.
We have a suggestion from Ralph in Folsom. He says, "We appreciate how you hold the coaches and administration's feet to the fire. Not sure when you'll have the chance, but can you try asking Coach Helton something like the following?" Which, Dan, I think you already have, but we'll see. He says, "Coach, we heard from Lynn Swann about the deficiencies in culture, scheme, etc. We are aware of the changes you have made to your staff. However, can you tell us how you, personally, not the young men or the staff, are going to alter your approach in order to improve the culture, which some would say is soft, undisciplined, and lacking in physicality?"
Yeah, I think the physicality part of it, it all comes down to practice and seeing it as a quarterback. And I think the other part that Brian Kelly should have gotten a lot of credit for at Notre Dame, he interviewed every one of his players, and the basic part of the interview was, what are we not doing for you? What are we not getting done? What do you need from us to get better? And I know, there was some talk with the players about they weren't being physical enough, they weren't being challenged enough in practice. But I would like to see Clay go through that exercise of sitting down and, taking a good bit of time with every player on this team and, really getting through to them, in terms of having them get through to him. in terms of, you know, challenging him to figure out how to get, you know, how to get more physical. I mean, I just thought, you know, for example, if you watch Texas, they went into the Georgia game, you know, here they are playing, a, you know, one of the big tough guys in the SEC, and they went in with the idea, we're going to be more physical in this game than Georgia is. Well, that's, you know, that's a lot of credit for, you know, Texas is a team that doesn't have probably as much talent on the field as USC did. But they played hard, and they got better, and they didn't, you know, they didn't, you know, give up on anything. And, I mean, I just thought that, you know, the teams that said that they were going to be more physical and work at it and believe in it are getting better. Those are the teams that are, you know, still around. And USC has to figure out how to do that. As that's the, you know, the one criticism, it's just that they don't get it done in practice. I watched the long pregame stuff in the playoffs. So they were, like last year, we had been down at the Cotton Bowl and we watched Ohio State and I thought, just watching pregame warmups, Ohio State was working harder in pregame warmups than USC ever did during any single practice. Then watching Clemson work out before the game last week, and you're watching them having their wide receivers and defense or an offensive backs running down the field and throwing blocks, you know, throwing their bodies on the ground, rolling as if, you know, they were, you know, blocking downfield, and, you know, and just thought, wow, that's something you never see USC do. That, you know, they basically, USC's practices mostly have guys standing around. They're standing, I mean, not just standing around, but they're standing a lot. They don't, they're not down on the ground. They're not playing football where it often is played at the, you know, at the goal line and short yardage situation. And you can't do that if you're always in shorts or you're mostly in shorts. But that's not how football is played. And they've got to figure out, that was the genius of Pete Carroll, is that practices were very comparable and sometimes more competitive and more game-like than games. And if there's a, you know, if this coaching staff hasn't figured something out, it's how do you make practice as close to games as possible? If you're practicing differently than you, you know, than you have to play in a game, then that practice isn't doing you that much good. So yeah, that's got to happen. And it's hard sometimes when you talk to Clay about it, it's like you talk past one another. It's like there's not a, like a meeting of the minds in terms of what exactly you're talking about and what exactly, you know, Clay is talking about. And it's just that the reality sometimes that we see is not necessarily the reality that Clay sees. And that's, I think that's where some things really have to happen in this off season is, you know, a kind of a different reality, you know, for the USC coaches in terms of, you know, what happened in 2018. And I don't know if they get there or not, but that's the discussion that has to be, you know, had.
And to your credit, Dan, I feel like you asked Clay a similar question to what Ralph suggested during the early signing day presser. And like you said, it seemed like it was just a different page for Clay Helton. I got the feeling that he still tried to make last year's season an isolated incident. As we mentioned earlier, he apologized for losing close games. And in reality, it was a symptom of the whole season. It wasn't just, oh, tough losses. It was fundamental errors that happened throughout the season. So it's interesting. We can't always get a good answer out of Clay, even if we ask the tough questions.
But yeah, I'm not sure he doesn't see it the way we see it. And I know it's like, well, you know, here's a guy getting paid, what, $2.8 million a year and, you know, been coaching for 24 years in college and all that. But that's the way it is. I mean, we see what we see and, you know, I mean, and I think the results probably point in our direction in terms of what we see and how we respond. I mean, you know, you just aren't seeing teams that are prepared for the physicality that they're going to, you know, face and the physicality that they have to play with, and the confidence that that develops. If you know you're going to be, I mean, that's one of the things I thought with Texas, that they were very confident that they could slug it out with Georgia and that they could win that battle. That's pretty, you know, giving them a lot of credit because they really believed in themselves. I don't think USC has that belief at all that we're going to line up with somebody who's pretty darn good and we're going to be able to, you know, beat them at their own game and we're going to out-physical them. I don't think there's that sense whatsoever. And that has to come back. I mean, when Pete was here, at least, you know, certainly during the golden age and all that, nobody that played USC thought they were going to out hit USC. Nobody who played USC thought they were going to out physical USC. And they were right. They weren't. You know, USC might have lost some games and they screwed up, you know, here, there, wherever. They didn't get anybody got, you know, beat them physically. That's not the case now. USC, I think, has to go back to being what made USC football great since the 20s. We were physical, where they were fast and physical and aggressive. And I don't think we see anywhere near enough of that, approach. And when you're in the Pac-12, if you're not the most physical team, you're not doing something right if you're at USC. I mean, when you get manhandled by UCLA, for example, you've really done something wrong. And you've got to take a look at that and say, what do we have to change? That can't happen again. And I think the UCLA game of all, as bad as the Cal game was, what happened in the UCLA game just is, just impossible to comprehend that UCLA team out-physicaled USC the way they did, just, and they believed they could. What does that tell you? That UCLA goes into that game thinking they can slug it out with USC and that they can win, and they did. Can't do that.
No.
Definitely cannot. Scotty and HB wants to know, did you, Dan, ever cover the Kentucky air raid teams of Hal Mumme and Mike Leach? It would be interesting to contrast those teams to what Kingsbury does. Also, if you haven't read The Perfect Pass by S.C. Gwynn, it's a fun book for even casual football fans. It covers the evolution of the forward pass and development of air raid under Hal Mumme. Super easy to read and engrossing. Thanks for all you do and the team. Happy New Year.
Yeah, I was just moving on when he got there. I did cover. I got to know Tim Couch, who was the high school quarterback that from down in Eastern Kentucky, who people thought was better than Peyton Manning. And I always thought, you know, I went to a high school practice, and I'm trying to remember. I think he completed like 197 out of 200 passes. I mean, counting everything, warm-ups. But he had an unbelievable arm, and he played in the in Hal Mumme's air raid. And they had so many quick, short passes. I swear he injured his arm. He was the number one draft pick by the Browns. And he had an okay career. He had no offensive line to protect him. But Hal Mumme did things so differently, it was almost impossible to even figure out, is this good? Is this bad? I mean, Kentucky, you know, came back under him a little bit. They were really different. In the SEC, they didn't know what to make of Kentucky. They didn't have as many, you know, players and athletes as everybody else, but they did some crazy things. But there were other things going on with Hal Mumme off the field in terms and just with the program and all that maybe you didn't pay as much attention to, you know, the way they were, you know, running the air raid. And Mike Leach was an assistant down there. It was, I don't think we knew at the time that it was going to change college football the way it did. And it did. I just don't think, you know, who would think that one of the things that's, you know, most changed college football started at Kentucky under Hal Mumme. I mean, people, yeah, you're right. That's and Mike Leach was right there and all that. I don't think anybody at Kentucky realized that's what was happening, but other people did, I guess, eventually. But it was very unusual to watch how they did things. And it was so different, you just almost couldn't get a handle on it. But now everybody kind of does it in high school. So it was really different then.
We have a bit of a longer question from Stephen Poway, so hang tight, Dan. He says, looking back on the 2018 football season, there is no doubt that poor coaching played a role in the losing season, and that seems to be the prevailing narrative of the season. However, what role do you believe youth and inexperience played into the losses? As far as youth goes, according to the scholarship distribution chart on the USCfootball.com site, there were 12 seniors, 17 juniors, including 3 punters, 2 redshirts, and 1 guy I have never heard of, Jake Russell, which, sidebar, Jake Russell is a walk-on wide receiver who actually blocked a punt in the UCLA game, 22 sophomores, 34 freshmen. And he says, as far as inexperience, we all know that the team had to replace the top 3 offensive playmakers from 2017, including Sam Darnold, replacing him with a young man who really should have been finishing up his final year in high school. If we had either more seniority or experience, or both, how many of the last 4 losses, which we lost by a total of only 18 points, do you think would have gone the other way? Thank you, Steve in Poway.
Steve, I'm not sure. I think, you know, at the end of the year against this schedule with a young team, that's when having a young team really helps, because by that time you're ready to play. I mean, they should not have tailed off the way they did. I don't think there's any excuse for that. I think if you look at college football today, you look at Clemson, you look at Alabama, they're playing young guys. You know, they're the kind of talent the top teams have available. You have to play young guys. So I think that's mostly a cop out. I think that's a cop out by the coaches in general, not getting guys up to speed. I mean, Talanoa Hufanga and Paulie Niao Teote and all those guys that were true freshmen who needed to be on the field as much as possible. And, you know, if you can't teach them the defense, find a defense you can teach them. If your best tacklers, I mean, the fact that they're 2 best tacklers, if you don't count Cam Smith, were true freshmen. You know, you can't teach necessarily the kind of tackling ability those guys had. You just got to get it organized to the point where they can contribute. And by the time you're into those last 4 games, those guys ought to be ready to play. They shouldn't be tailing off. You shouldn't be scoring 14 points against Cal or, you know, whatever the UCLA game turned out the way, you know, they just didn't have, you know, what it took to get it finished. That's not acceptable. So I think it's a factor, the youth, but I think more of a factor was the inability to, make use of the talents that those guys had. And one of the difficult things was Sam Darnold. He started playing and started showing you his talent when the play broke down. So Sam wasn't as influenced by an offense that nobody seemed to know what they were doing, because he would turn that into an advantage, because he would beat the first pass rusher. They'd be playing 11 on 10. He had Deontay Burnett, who could find an open spot. The guys had played together enough, and they made that work. You had a home run hitter in the backfield who, if somebody made a mistake on defense, he could take it all the way. This year you didn't have that, so you had to drive the ball. You had to, not commit penalties. You had to not stop yourself. All the things that go with coaching and coaching them up, and that's where they were missing. You know, you needed, you know, if you've got JT Daniels, you really need an offense to go with him. You need an offensive line that could give him some time. And you needed to really know what you were doing, and that wasn't happening. So I think the youth was only a small part of. Yes, he still had better players than 4 or 5 of the teams they lost to. You know, and you can say they were young, but everybody's got young players. The way college football is now, and the better teams almost. I mean, I would say like a Fresno State was really heavily 4th and 5th year guys. And that's what you're going to get with a program like Fresno State, where you're going to have a chance to develop them because you don't have the stars. You don't have the guys going off to the NFL. But when you get, you know, programs like, you know, USC, and, you know, I hate to even mention them right now with Alabama and Clemson, those programs are going to have guys that pretty much have to play right away because of their talent. And you've got to be able to coach them up right away. And then you've got to get them better as the season goes on. You cannot have them do what they did this year. So I'm not a big proponent of the fact that, oh, it was inexperience that cost USC this year.
Jim B. says, John Jackson III, do you think that he will ever get on the field, or was that just a wasted scholarship?
Man, they've got so many guys. You could ask that question about a lot of wide receivers. You know, will they ever get on the field? Josh Amater, baby. You know, you look at him and you remember, you know, his 44-inch vertical and at Nike camp, and you remember, you know, and you look at him and all the things, and you just, is he going to, you know, get on the field? And he's not the only one to single out. You could, you know, there are a lot of guys you can, you know, wonder, are they going to get on the field? So it's a good question. I don't know. I think he's pretty good. Watching Clemson, and for example, he reminds me a little bit of Amari Rodgers, who's not a breakaway speed guy, strong guy, tough guy. And they get him open enough that he can make catches. If you're at USC with that same skill set, will they get you open enough? We didn't see it last year. We saw a lot of guys having to make a lot of really good plays. And a lot of times the ball has to be thrown into coverage. So we'll see. I think the offense is going to change enough that you're going to see wide receivers maybe you haven't seen making plays that maybe will surprise you. But I think it's got to be a good thing for the wide receivers.
Did we ever nail down what his scholarship status was? Because he wasn't actually practicing with the team during
no.
the fall.
I think he was gray-shirted.
I don't know. Was he? I think he's gray-shirted. I don't know that he was even in school, was he?
I think he was going to a community college. Because a gray shirt right. is when you wait an extra semester before you are actually on the team.
Yeah.
Right, he'll be on next year's recruiting class. So, yeah, he gets his scholarship starting the second semester.
And I don't know if anything's changed. I mean, if you hadn't heard, you know, John Jackson, his dad, the second, he unfortunately suffered a stroke. He's still in the hospital now. He's been in the hospital, I think, for 5 or 6 weeks. We posted on the message board. There was they were trying to keep everything very private, but there was a P.O. box you can send, like gift cards or anything too, or well wishes cards, things like that. So, we wish him a speedy recovery. I've been getting updates once a week or so. It seems like he's doing better. You know, he was not awake for quite a while and doing a lot better now. So, I'm not saying that would have any sort of impact on, you know, what his son was going to do, but the family's going through that right now. So maybe, I don't know if that changed anything, but just for people to be aware. And, you know, certainly hoping speedy recovery for John Jackson, who, if you know, he was, you know, covered USC for a long time, covered high school football and stuff. So we've seen him around quite a bit.
Yeah, really good guy. And amazing because he would, you know, he does all the high school games. And, you know, every week he's out there, you know, with those high school, you know, top high school prospects, and he's running patterns or playing fast defense or whatever. And to have, you know, him get, you know, taken down by a stroke like that at his age is really, you know, kind of shocking. I think makes it really hard probably, you know, for them to handle, you know, the family. I mean, you just don't expect that, you know, nothing but our, you know, prayers and best wishes and really good guy and, you know, great Trojan and, would love to see him, you know, get back and, you know, be able to do everything that he's been doing because he's a real asset, you know, to USC. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I second that. We have one final question, and it's a basketball question, so maybe, Ryan, you should cover your ears.
I will.
Earl in West LA says, what is the backstory behind the suspension and transfer of Jordan Usher?
We just heard maybe something in practice that just you know, because he played the game before, and then all of a sudden he was gone, and that something happened at practice is all that I've heard, and that you know, it just boom. He certainly didn't leave saying any really bad things or anything, but it sure sounded like when they just decided whatever happened couldn't continue. So that's all I got for you. I don't know anything else other than something that happened at practice.
Well,
yeah, that's, it's funny. We talk about hoops sometimes and Shockton's like, oh, they're going to be really good. They're going to be really good. I'm like, I don't think they're going to be really good. And they're not really good. They're not going to make the tournament. I'm like, USC basketball wins like the offseason. They get great recruiting classes and all these things are looking positive, but for whatever reason, they're just not able to put it together. So we'll see. Maybe they'll make some.
I will say the next year and the year after, the guys that are lined up, if they screw that, you know, next year's class up, then you really know basketball just isn't in the cards for USC. But that class they got coming in next year, and then the year after. They're number one, you know, class in the country coming in, which is just kind of hard to believe. Although, you know, this Kevin Porter, the guard, freshman guard out of Washington, Rainier Beach, was the kind of kid that had such a great summer that people were projecting him as a top 10, NBA draft pick after a year. And as he played 3 minutes this year for USC, he got hurt, you know, a thigh contusion, and hasn't basically seen the floor. So you just never know.
Crazy. All right. Well, that's enough basketball talk. we don't want to do that if we don't have to. Okay. So let's, I guess we'll wrap things up here.
Got through all the questions.
We got through them all. Thanks. Yeah.
Can't throw any of us this time, Ryan.
Keely. Yeah. Keely, you know, good job, Keely. You didn't.
Thanks.
I don't think she read everyone's name or anything, but.
I did. I made sure. Someone did twice. So nobody write any emails.
We're just teasing with you, Keely. All right. Well, hopefully you guys enjoyed our little show here and enjoy the brand new year, 2019. It's going to be a good one, I think. I feel good.
That's good.
Yeah. I'm doing a juice cleanse, though, so I'm not feeling great.
Kind of odd.
I'm very hungry to start this new year, but we'll see. Hopefully I'll make through it for 3 days. I made it half a day, so we'll see if I can go a little further.
Does a 3-day juice cleanse do anything?
Makes you hungry. I don't know. Like,
okay.
We'll see. I've seen ones that are like 5 days and 3 days, but whatever. But I did one a couple years ago. Actually, I think I lost like 8 pounds or something.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But then I ate like a whole bunch of donuts the next day.
Yeah, that doesn't really work well.
I mean, I lost 8 pounds, but then I like to eat. So I just did that.
Then you gained it all back?
Yeah, probably. all right. Well, that's Dan Weber. That's Keely Yore. I'm Ryan Abraham. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Peristyle Podcast. And we will talk to you next time.
You may have noticed that shopping at Trader Joe's is unlike shopping at other markets. People ask us all the time how we manage to have such unique, interesting, and delicious products at such great everyday prices. This is Dan Bain of Trader Joe's. The answer is simple. It's all in the way we do business. We buy directly from the manufacturer whenever possible. This helps to keep our costs low, and we pass those savings on to you. No gimmicks, just great values at honest prices every day at Trader Joe's. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on PeristylePodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.